Chapter 17 Rock and Roll All Night. The return of Kiss tour hit the road in the summer of 1979. The first concert was scheduled for June 15th in Lakeland, Florida. I would be there. I had been working since spring, building a new collection of special effects guitars for Ace. Tex and I had worked with luthier Steve Carr to make my electronic creations playable. Carr had done the fretwork and final finishing, and Tex had test-played the guitars. I had designed and built the electronics. The band had just released Dynasty, and their songs were once again climbing the charts. For this tour, the band would be using all new equipment. The stage was new. The effects were new. The costumes were new. And all the special guitars we had created were new. All that new stuff would be very exciting, except for the worry, would it really work? A week before the first show, the rest of the crew had arrived in Florida to set up, and I was down to the wire. It seemed like I was working 25 hours a day. Tex and the road manager were calling me daily, asking what was taking so long, and I was in a state of high anxiety. "We're all here waiting, Ampy," Tex would say. "The tour is starting." Back home, we were building and refining right up to the last minute. Would it really work? At a real concert? In front of an audience? I sure hoped so. I finally arrived at the Orlando airport on a bright, hot Thursday morning, 2 days before the show. With my cut-off blue jeans and long hair and beard, I looked more like a biker than a Florida tourist, but there I was. I had a bag of clothes, a box packed with explosives, tools, parts, and weapons, and two guitar cases. As I trooped off the plane, I found myself surrounded by hundreds of moms and kids headed for a big weekend at Disney World. They were loud, they were rude, they smelled funny, and most kept a respectful distance from me. We all rode the monorail from the gate into the terminal building. Stray kids climbed over the luggage as I waited for my bags to emerge. I tried to remember what I'd read about the Florida gun laws and wondered which ones I was violating. Outside the terminal, it was like a steam bath. I had flown first class, and now I rented a Lincoln, the most air-conditioned vehicle they had. I charged it all to the band. If those guitars worked, they would pay any bill I handed in. If they didn't work, a new life in the Caribbean was just a one-hour plane ride away. I headed for the hotel, a sprawling two-story structure with peeling stucco, mold, and a faintly foul smell at the edge of a swamp. Everything in Florida was at the edge of a swamp. It was all swamp, except where people had drained it and paved it or built something. They gave me a room on the first floor in back with two beds and a TV. The hotel was not what I expected in an upscale chain. Everything was run down and cheap. The beds were hard, the chairs were flimsy, and there was a bottle opener bolted to the counter in the bathroom, within easy reach of the toilet. It was the sort of place where you didn't put your hands anywhere you couldn't see. The kind of place where even the grown-ups peed in the pool. But I figured it would do. I was only planning to be there 2 nights. After I shut the door, I unpacked the guitars and laid them on one of the beds, carefully, so nothing would get scratched. They both used the Fresolini rechargeable battery packs, so I plugged the guitars into their chargers and made sure the ready lights were lit. Nothing seemed to have broken on the ride down. The guitars needed to charge for at least an hour before they could be used. While I was waiting, I retrieved my revolver and tour pass from the bottom of my suitcase. I got the bullets out of another bag. Even then, it was against the law to carry a loaded gun on a plane, and filled the revolver's chamber, then stuck the gun under the false bottom of my Halliburton briefcase. When the guitars were ready, I picked up the light one and gave the speed knob a quick twist. It came to life, with stripes of light moving over the face of the guitar. All 750 little lamps seemed to be working. I could feel the heat from the lamps on my hand under the clear plastic face. I shut it off to save the battery. I picked up the smoker and worked the mechanism. I hit the light switch and watched the lamp come on for a few seconds. I looked inside. There was nothing left to do. I was as ready as I was going to get. I carried them to the car. When I arrived at the arena, most of the setup work was done. Some of the guys were standing around a buffet eating catered food. Another fellow was flying a model airplane over the seats, and two carpenters were behind the stage doing line after line of coke. They asked if I wanted some. The coke could keep you moving, but I was zippy enough as it was. With all my worries about whether my stuff would work, I didn't need any drugs to keep me going. I carried the guitar cases past the coke line and back into the dressing rooms where we'd set them up. Most of the people on the crew had never seen them before, and a crowd filled the room and spilled into the hall. Tex and Paul, the two crew members who handled the guitars, moved in close to check them out for the first time. Everyone broke into grins when Tex turned on the light guitar and stripes of white light began running up and down the body. The light on the wall was like ripples swimming across a pond, but bright. "That is incredibly cool, Ampy." A crowd gathered. No one had ever seen anything like that before. "Damn, Ampy, that thing is bright." Someone shut off the ceiling lights, and we all watched it for a moment. It was starting to feel like a winner. Ace arrived. He picked the guitar up and turned it in his hands, carefully, as though it were alive and might bite. I could understand that. When you held it, you could feel the heat from the lamp sweep up and down your skin as the patterns changed. It actually felt alive. With your hand on the face, it brushed your palm as it ran. "Far out! Fucking Ampy! This is wild!" We carried the guitars to the stage and plugged into Ace's stack of 6 Marshall amplifiers. The sounds filled the empty Civic Center. He loved them, and I was so proud and relieved. There was one more night before the show. Kiss played on custom-built staging, and I needed to have some stuff welded to the aluminum frames on Ace's side of the stage to hold pieces for one of the guitars. I told the head carpenter what I needed, and he said he'd have it done that night. "But that's a big favor. You owe me a full gallon of Tanqueray gin," he said. What could I do but agree? After all my anxiety about those guitars working, I was too cranked up to sleep. But eventually, I went back to my room and passed out. When I woke up, the sun was shining brightly through my windows. I had a ground floor room looking out onto a lawn that sloped down into tall marsh grasses. The view was kind of pretty, marred only by the sign on the lawn about 10 feet from the door. "Warning. Reptiles. Do not proceed beyond this point." I hadn't noticed the sign before, but I hadn't paid much attention to anything but those guitars when I arrived. Thinking I would take a picture of it, I opened the door and almost stepped on a large black water moccasin sunning himself on the concrete patio. My concrete patio. He was 3 feet long and fat, almost as thick as my leg. Nasty looking. The snake saw me, and he quickly reared back and opened his mouth, ready to strike. The inside was all white, with a little bit of pink. I had seen snakes like him before, on my grandparents' farm. Rattlesnakes would run away if you gave them the chance, but water moccasins would stand their ground or even attack. This one must have been thinking attack. I quickly closed the door and considered what to do next. The first time I saw a poisonous snake, I was probably 8 years old. Even then, I knew just what to do. I went into the house. I went to the encyclopedia and turned to snake. I read all about them. Water moccasins were bad, and so were rattlers and copperheads. But I learned there were far more dangerous snakes elsewhere in the world. I decided then and there not to visit those places. As a child, I had read that the risk of death from a snake bite was less than the risk of drowning in a swimming pool or being killed in a car accident. But those statistics didn't apply today. Today, I had an angry, venomous snake 2 feet away, with just a flimsy steel motel door between me and him. I had to do something. If I went back to sleep, housekeeping would arrive to clean the room, and they'd let him in. I certainly didn't want him crawling in with me. If I wanted a chance to drown in the pool or die in a car accident, I would have to remove the snake or make it past him alive. The odds had turned. People up north say, "Why do people kill them? Snakes are okay. They won't hurt you unless you provoke them." Down south, they don't say things like that. They know better. On my grandparents' farm, Gerald, a hired hand, jabbed a water moccasin with a stick, thinking it would slither away. It didn't. Quick as lightning, it climbed the stick and bit him. His hand turned purple and he almost died. When I was 15, one dropped off a branch into a rowboat I was paddling, and I shot it 6 times, clubbed it with an oar, and it still tried to bite me. The rowboat almost sank too. My great-grandfather Dandy had long ago told me the best answer to any snake question. "Number 6 shot." That's what he loaded into the sawed-off shotgun that he carried in the high grass and swampland. I didn't have a shotgun, but I had the next best thing. I went to my briefcase and took out my revolver. Dumping the hollow points onto the bed, I quickly loaded it with snake shot. Snake shot is like steel gravel encased in a cartridge. Why would I have snake shot on a rock and roll tour, you ask? Don't. I was always armed, and I spent my summers in the South. I knew plenty about what lived in the Florida swamps. I was ready. I opened the door, stepped out, lowered the gun, and shot that snake twice before he had a chance to collect his thoughts and bite me. The first shot knocked him down. The second shot blew him back about 10 feet into the grass. I stepped out and shot him 4 more times just to be safe. As the sound of the shots faded away, I looked around. The cloud of gun smoke was dissipating. The snake was in 2 pieces. The tail was twitching. The bathers at the pool had all dived for cover. Some were in the water, some under the chairs. No one was moving. "It's okay, folks. Just a snake." I smiled and waved the gun reassuringly. Still, nobody moved. I realized I was standing outside next to a pool full of kids and sunbathing parents in my underwear, waving a smoking revolver. I turned and went back into my room. I looked under the beds to make sure that snake didn't have a brother that had sneaked in while I was outside. Then I reloaded the gun and put on some pants and a shirt. There is nothing more useless than an unloaded gun in a motel room. I called the front desk and asked for the manager. When he came online, I said, "There was a water moccasin just outside my door, but it's okay because I shot it. Can you send housekeeping up to clean the patio?" I expected him to thank me, but he didn't. He went wild. "You shot a gun in my hotel? Are you crazy? You are in big trouble, mister. You are going to jail. Don't you go anywhere. I'm calling the police." Moments later, he appeared in my doorway, looking deranged and red in the face, shattering my tranquility. The sheriff's deputy came by in a few minutes. He was big, at least 250 pounds, with the mirrored sunglasses the police down south like to wear. He didn't look too friendly, but I knew that was just for show. I had talked to him earlier when he stopped by the Civic Center to see the security arrangements for the show. He'd been in the service in Vietnam, and we'd talked about the LAWS anti-tank rockets he'd used over there and how I wanted to use them in stage effects here. I had shown him some of the pyrotechnic devices we used in the shows. I was just beginning to work on rocket guitars.
"What happened here?" he said in a slow drawl.
"I opened my door, and that snake was there, waiting to bite me. So I shot him," I said. "Lucky for me, I had a gun and I was alert. If I hadn't been paying attention, I could have been bit bad." The deputy nodded his head. He observed that the first chunk was shot out of the concrete no more than 2 feet from my door, easy biting distance for a bad-tempered cottonmouth. He turned to the manager and said,
"Goddamn, Fred, you're lucky this here boy was prepared. You'd have had a real mess on your hands if that snake would have bit him or some kid."
The manager quivered a little and nodded. It was clear he didn't share the sheriff's point of view. I'm sure he would have preferred that the snake had slipped into someone's room, bit them, and left. Housekeeping would have found the body, dead and purple, and the undertaker would have hauled it away. quietly. No gunshots. No disturbance. After all, dead people were a fact of life in Florida hotel rooms. Gunshots weren't, at least not in Lakeland. Then the deputy turned to me and said,
"What'd you shoot him with, son?"
So I showed him. He handed me back the gun and said,
"That's a fine gun. If I couldn't kill a snake with that, I'd just drop it and back away slowly and wish that snake a good day."
He had no comment at all about why a guy like me might have a big revolver and a gold briefcase. We all had guns. That was Florida in 1979. And with that, the deputy left. I decamped for the Hilton, where I had no further reptile problems. But first I insisted on a credit for the room charge, as the place had clearly been unsatisfactory. The firm and positive manner in which I had dealt with a poisonous snake convinced the manager of the reasonableness of my argument. The incident with the snake had been a welcome distraction, but I was still plenty worried about how my equipment would do at its first show. Tex and I set up both guitars, and we checked and rechecked until it was time to go on. I went outside and walked in circles around the building until the show started, because I couldn't sit still. The crowd was getting bigger, and by my third orbit there must have been 10,000 people in the parking lot. I walked toward the main entrance, where 50 or more outlaw bikers had set up camp while they waited for the gates to open. I walked over to check out the bikes. One of the bikers saw my backstage pass, and he trotted over.
"Hey, man, can you get me and my buddies inside? We have some acid and other shit, too."
I was afraid to say I never touched acid. Two more bikers joined the first one. One had a heavy chain around his neck. They were considerably dirtier and smellier than I had ever been. They appeared to cultivate filth.
"You want a beer?"
The police were eyeing them already, wondering if they should try to arrest them for having open bottles in public. The bikers were eyeing the law, wondering if they had the balls to try to arrest them for having open bottles in public. So far, it was a standoff. A biker with no front teeth ambled over. He grinned. I was now surrounded.
"How many of us can you get in?"
"We got some great shit."
"You want a bitch? We got plenty if you want one. Ellie there is hot."
She didn't have any front teeth either. I was reluctant to decline the female bikers because the males looked dangerous, but I wasn't interested in a toothless, smelly, possibly diseased female. Unsure how to frame a polite response, I stood still for a few seconds. That gave them the wrong idea.
"You queer?"
"Okay, guys, I'll see what I can do," I said. I pulled out my pass and went to the front door and banged hard. When the security guy opened it, I waved my pass in his face, said, "Thanks," and headed back inside, out of sight, as quick as I could. I didn't go out front again. I was learning about mingling with the crowds. Backstage, I couldn't stand still. The waiting was killing me. I kept talking to myself. Is my stuff going to work? How many minutes till the show starts? I walked to the back door, hoping the air would be fresher. It wasn't. There weren't any bikers out back, though, so I stepped out. Now there was a crowd gathered by the back entrance to see the band drive in. I tucked my pass out of sight. There were people dressed up as Kiss lookalikes, 10-year-old girls with their mothers, even a guy dressed like a medieval magician. As the parking lot filled, I found myself driven to the edge of the grass. I walked back around to the front, keeping an eye out for reptiles, went back in, and made my way to the front of the stage. There was an aisle there, with a 6-foot-high crowd barrier and security guys patrolling back and forth like guard dogs in a prison. We nodded to each other as we passed. Some of them had sticks, and I had a gun. We were ready. I watched the audience pour into the hall. Would my stuff work? Finally, it was showtime. The band opened with King of the Nighttime World and moved into Radioactive. I was so wound up, I didn't even hear them. Then it was time. Ace picked up the smoking guitar and began to play his solo. I didn't even breathe as I watched for his fingers to turn the knob that fired the bombs. When he cranked it, I heard the snap through the speakers, and the light glared from the front of the guitar while smoke poured out. Still, he kept playing, and the smoke kept getting thicker. Now the audience was on its feet. They were applauding. For my guitar. I was thrilled. I was so relieved. I almost collapsed as Ace's solo wound down and the song came to an end. The lights dimmed, and he handed my guitar off for another one for the next song. But there was still one guitar to go. A few songs later, Ace picked it up and stood facing away from the audience as he turned it on. The whole stage was dark. Everyone could see something flashing behind him, but no one knew what it was. He lit into the opening chords of New York Groove, then turned around and the audience roared. I couldn't believe it. It was probably the proudest moment of my life, seeing the audience respond to my guitar like that. It was the hit of the show, and it was on the TV news that night. I was ecstatic. For once, everyone loved me. Backstage after the show, Ace was all over me with questions about the guitars. Ampy, can you make one that shoots rockets? Can you make one that shoots 9mm pistol ammunition? Can you make a laser guitar? Can we make the smoking guitar fly? Can we blow it up at the end of the song? Sure, we can do all that. I sounded confident, even though my head was spinning. But I knew I could do it. And I was sure Jim and Little Bear would help. Ace had 5 brand new Les Paul guitars for spares. I took one out and retreated into my corner to consider the next move. When I got up the next day, I felt like a new person. My stuff had worked. I had proven myself. I had been so afraid it would all be a failure and that I would head home in disgrace. All of a sudden, I was on top of the world. The tour was starting and I had stuff to build. I realized I had not come to Florida with any fresh underwear or socks. I had 1 pair of pants and 2 t-shirts. I needed clean clothes. 2 hours and $500 later, I was transformed. Gone was the old Ampy in ripped blue jeans and an outlaw biker shirt. Now I had a supply of respectable shorts and shirts with alligators and horses on them. If Orlando had only had a yacht club, I could have hung out and not been evicted. Still, I was on tour, and I'd be visiting other cities where children and sales clerks would no longer edge away slowly at my approach. I considered getting a haircut, but settled for a shower. Then it was time for lunch. The waitress smiled at me. "I'll have 2 hamburgers, a bowl of the chowder, and 4 glasses of iced tea, and a brownie sundae in a few minutes." Silence. "Thanks." I was trying to remember to be polite and still order efficiently. I wanted my food. The Lincoln was starting to stink from the dirty clothes in the back seat. I packed them into a box and sent it home, using the band's FedEx account. By the time I got back home a few months later, the smell had dissipated. I washed them anyway, of course. Then I went back to the Civic Center and talked with Ace about the guitars to come. Now I had a mission. I returned to the hotel and started making diagrams and plans. I had figured to hand over that gallon of gin after the second show, but it didn't work out that way. While I was putting my gear away, I was startled by a commotion at the doors. It was the DEA. They came in and headed straight backstage. I shrank behind the equipment cases to render myself less visible and waited. They came out from backstage a moment later with 2 of our carpenters in handcuffs and a sack full of something. Tex said, "They've got a pound of coke in the bag." They wouldn't need my gallon of gin where they were headed. I carried that gin around for a month before I found someone else to give it to. I remained with the tour from Lakeland on. It was a hard life, but it was exciting, and I felt good seeing how people reacted to my creations. It was a wild life, too, something I had never experienced and didn't really know how to engage in. We played shows in South Florida where coke dealers came backstage with free samples. "Here, Ampy, take some." They had party trays with lines of coke and punch bowls of the stuff on tables. Big bowls, like you mix cookies in at home. They also had pills. Anything you wanted, we had it. And that wasn't all. We had madams come backstage with free samples, too. People would ask me, "Do you get lots of girls out there on tour?" People seemed to assume girls would throw themselves at me and that I'd take them up on their offers. But it didn't happen that way. I was still shy about meeting people, so I never initiated conversations with girls, and I never really considered spending the night with someone I was going to have to say goodbye to the following day. The whole thing just seemed creepy to me. And, of course, I had a girlfriend. "Who cares?" the guys would make fun of me. "When I leave home, it's open season on every girl I can catch," they boasted. Somehow, I just couldn't embrace that concept. The idea of having to meet and befriend one person after another was just too scary to me. Did any of the girls try to pick me up? I'll never know. My sensitivity to other people's actions was limited enough that any attempt to pick me up went unnoticed. I often felt lonely when I saw couples together, but I could not see any way I could change my own situation, so I just plodded along. When people were drinking and doing coke around me, I often felt confused. I didn't like feeling out of control, and I had seen people do outrageous things while they were drunk and have no memory of it the next day. The mere thought that I might do things like that was enough to make me cringe. So I didn't know what to do.
"Relax, Ampy. Here, have a line. Here, have a drink."
An observer would have said temptation was all around me, but to me it wasn't tempting at all. I did a few lines and I drank a few drinks, just enough to feel like I was being polite. I never felt the desire to pack in all the beer I could drink or all the coke I could snort. I just did not like how it made me feel. The few times I was drunk or on drugs, I would close my eyes and the world would spin, and I would say to myself, "When is this shit going to end? Why did I do this?" It didn't take me very long to outgrow it, if outgrow is the right word. I stopped doing drugs and liquor, and I didn't resume. One of the high points of any tour is being the headline act at Madison Square Garden. We were scheduled to play several shows there midway through the tour. When the road crew was setting up Ace's guitars, a rocket went off, sending Tex to the emergency room with burned fingers. We had no spare for that guitar, and I had to race to fix it. Showtime was coming, and people were starting to crowd around me in hopes I'd go faster.
"If you screw up and make us late, we're getting fined $10,000 a minute. Get that stuff up there."
Fritz, our road manager, stood over me, urging speed. I had not screwed up. I was saving his sorry ass. I was going as fast as I could.
"Go, go, go! Fines, Ampy, fines! Don't make us late."
We carried it up there and started on time, and it all worked. By 1980, my special effects guitars were a regular part of the show. Each of the guys had a gimmick. Gene flew through the air and spat fire and blood. He also played a bass that was shaped like a bloody battle axe. Paul had the eye and a mirrored Ibanez guitar that reflected the spotlights. And Ace had my customized Les Paul guitars. Every show, he would start into Mick Jagger's 2000 Man, playing a stock black Les Paul guitar. Halfway through, he would step to the edge of the stage and swap guitars for the Black Smoker. He'd begin playing his solo, and in the middle of it, he'd twist the knob that set off the smoke bomb and the lights. Ace's projector lamp threw a square of light all the way to the back of the hall, and smoke poured from the hole. The guitar really looked like it had caught fire. You could tell when Ace lit the smoking guitar just by listening to the audience. They loved it. We knew many Kiss fans came for the spectacle, and I did my best not to disappoint them. Our pyrotechnics wizard said, "Ampy, we set off more fireworks every show than most towns shoot on the 4th of July." I was inclined to believe him. After a few shows, we improved the smoking guitar still more. A second twist of the knob would fire a second, larger smoke bomb. Ace would almost vanish in the cloud, and the smoke would spread across the stage while the heat burned the strings right off the guitar as he continued to play. As each string burned through with a ping, the audience would roar. At that point, we would drop an invisible cable down from the ceiling. We had rigged a track up there that allowed the cable to drop down, pick something up, then lift it and swing it around, all by remote control. The cable was rigged with a coupler and a powerful electromagnet, and one of us would be at the controls to run it. The guitar had a steel hook to grab the cable. Ace would begin to swing the guitar at the end of his solo, looking like he was chopping the air with his guitar. When he felt the cable grab the hook, he'd throw the guitar out toward the audience, and it would start swinging around on the cable. One of the crew would be reeling the cable in slowly, so the guitar was swinging and rising into the air. Meanwhile, I'd be standing to the side with a radio control rig that I'd scavenged from a model airplane. I'd start flashing the lights in the guitar off and on. It would look like a lighthouse beacon, swinging and flashing as it rose 50 feet above the stage. From that height, the flashes would shine all the way to the back of the hall, no matter how big a place we played. And some of those places were big. It seemed like a quarter mile from the stage to the last row of seats in huge arenas like Detroit's Pontiac Silverdome. While everyone watched the guitar, Ace was stepping over and grabbing the rocket guitar to play the next part. The rocket guitar was another Les Paul, identical in appearance to the last two. It had a 3-tube rocket launcher at the end of the neck. He'd start playing his solo again, and then he'd step up to the front of the stage, stamp his foot, swing the guitar to the left, and fire the first rocket. The audience could hear a bang, and they saw the flash from the end of the guitar neck. We had hung a bag of flash powder and confetti from the roof above the audience, about 100 feet back, and we'd blow it up when he fired. The audience would think we were shooting airburst shells over their heads. It was a great effect. The crowd loved it. Then he'd swing to the right and fire again, and we'd blow another bag of flash powder. The flash powder bombs were filled with confetti that would rain down on the crowd for 10 seconds or so. As the confetti from the first two bombs was falling, he'd point his guitar up and fire the finale, straight up at the burning smoker. We'd blow up the biggest charge of all, and I'd use the radio control to shut the smoker off. When everything went dark, the crowd assumed he'd blown it up. It worked really well, too, until we played Olympic Stadium in Munich. At that show, the charge from the rocket guitar actually hit the smoker, and it fell 70 feet and shattered in the crowd barrier in front of the stage. There was a riot as mobs swarmed over the barrier to grab chunks of guitar. There was nothing left of it. I jetted home so we could make a new smoker, and then I flew it back to Germany. I got 2 first-class tickets, one for the guitar and one for me. Chapter 18. A Real Job. By the end of the 1970s, despite my success with Kiss, I was barely making a living. I was working for the big bands as much as I could, but they only needed me to get ready for a tour. Then I went home, the money ran out, and I was flat broke. In Texas, on tour, I dined at the mansion on Turtle Creek and charged it to the band. I ate exquisite gourmet meals served by perfectly dressed waiters on fine china. In Atlanta, I dined at Trotter's, beneath oil paintings of racehorses and jockeys. Limousines and private planes ferried me from place to place. Back in Amherst, I had a Cadillac Eldorado convertible, but I couldn't afford the gas to drive it. I dined on Kraft macaroni and cheese. When I couldn't afford milk to mix it properly, I made a slurry of water and macaroni and powdered cheese and ate it like that. I foraged for leftover slices at Bruno's Pizza and robbed the condiment bowls for dessert. Instead of the Plaza Hotel, with its beautiful wallpaper and marble bathrooms, I stayed at 288 Federal Street, with newspaper plastered on the walls and a plastic sink in a 4-foot-square bathroom with a stand-up shower. It wasn't too hard being broke. Any apartment was better than living in a lean-to under a tree as I had for a time when I first left home. The hard part was living the contrast between being rich and being broke. It was like being smart and waking up one day to find yourself dumb as a rock, but able to remember your former brains. What I needed was stability. I needed $200 a week for 10 weeks, not $3,000 one day and nothing for 3 months.
Ampy, you should move to L.A. You could work on films with me.
You should move to New York. You'd have more work than you could handle. Everyone was full of well-meaning advice about where I should go and what I should do. I was constantly reminded of the bright future I'd have if I moved to the big city. But I had grown up in the country. My favorite places were the Georgia countryside and the woods in Shutesbury. I didn't like cities. They were full of people. People who made me feel anxious. People I didn't know how to relate to. I understood animals, and I understood the country. I felt safe in the woods. I never felt safe in a city or a crowd. And I had someone else to think about. Little Bear was at UMass at Amherst, and we had just moved in together. She couldn't quit school, and I couldn't leave her. It is scary, but what if I did move? I asked myself that question at least once every day, but I didn't have confidence that anyone would keep me around. Nothing else in my life had lasted. I had dropped out of school. My family had fallen apart. The thought of starting a new life 2,000 miles away was overwhelming. I was also afraid to leave my parents. As much as I disliked them, I didn't want to go away and find they had just crawled into holes and died. And there was my brother, too. So long as he was living with Dr. Finch, I felt as though I needed to remain in the vicinity, on standby. I wouldn't find out until years later exactly what he had gone through, but instinct told me I needed to stick around. My father called every week.
"Son, I'm sorry I've been a burden to you. You won't have to worry about me anymore."
His words were slurred, but it didn't matter. He always said the same thing. He'd call me, drunk, from the floor of his apartment, then drop the phone on the floor. I'd have to drive over there and see what he was doing. Was he dead or just passed out? Wine, cigarettes, and trash were everywhere. It was like taking care of a child. "Get off the floor or I'm calling the cops. Get up, now."
"I'm sorry, John Elder, it's just so hard."
He was drunk and wallowing, but he got off the floor. In just 5 years, he'd gone from beating me up to being a blubbering baby. I guess he had hit bottom. He was broke. His house was gone. His family was gone. He had a $50 car, and he worked a second job as a security guard at Hampshire College to pay the bills. Visiting my mother was worse. She had moved into an apartment in town and was still seeing women. She had a girlfriend who could have been my aunt. It just seemed unnatural. And some of the other females I saw over there were more like acolytes than girlfriends. Sometimes it got even weirder than that.
"This is my daughter, Anne. She's your new sister," she told me.
Did she really believe some girl she took in was my sister? She was losing her marbles. Again. Soon enough, she was back at Northampton State Hospital, and my new sister had thrown my mother's stuff in the backyard and taken over the house. I was too ashamed ever to tell a stranger, or even a friend, what my parents were really like. "My parents teach at the university," I said. "My father is in philosophy," I would tell people. I made them sound clean, tweedy, and nice, not shackled to a wall, frothing like rabid dogs, behind 4 layers of locked doors, which was closer to the truth. At least I had Little Bear. She knew what they were really like. My friends had parents who sent them to college at places like Dartmouth and McGill. They had homes to return to, and they were in college. Not me. I rode my motorcycle back to Sunderland, a small town next to Amherst, to the 3-room apartment I shared with Little Bear and her 2 roommates. I was on my own, and I needed a job. Now. so I decided to do something about it. Jim Boughton and I started installing sound and light systems in local nightclubs. We started in the Amherst area and expanded south to Springfield. Then we went farther, to Boston and Hartford. The jobs didn't pay much, or we didn't know enough to charge much, but we had steady work. Going into a discotheque at noon to install sound equipment is very different from entering the same place at midnight. It's completely quiet, and there is no natural light because the windows and doors are painted flat black to keep people from looking in. Fluorescent work lights that are never on in the evening make the interior a uniform shade of gray. The place reeks of cigarette smoke and spilled liquor everywhere except the bathrooms. There, the stench of piss and vomit is stronger. A thin film of congealed smoke, sweat, and grease covers everything in the room. Wipe any surface with a white towel, and it comes up the color of fresh iced tea. That was our new workplace. We spent our days installing colored neon lights along the ceiling and subwoofers in corners that hadn't seen daylight in 40 years. We put turntables and a mixer into a newly built DJ booth, looking down onto the dance floor. It's enough to make a living, I told myself. And it's still music. We started returning at night to admire our creations. Little Bear seldom came with us to those places. It was usually just Boughton and me. We'd drive to one club, stay 30 minutes, and head to another. The VIP, the Viking, Infinity, the Arabian Nights, Mark Antony's. The doormen all knew us, so we got in free. If we were lucky, the bartenders knew us too, and we'd get free drinks. Not that I ever drank much anyway. I'd watch the girls in dresses, girls in skirts, girls with hardly any clothes at all. They arrived alone and in groups. Sometimes they left the way they came. Sometimes they got lucky and left with a guy. At least, I assumed they were lucky. I didn't leave with any girls, although I often wished I were as brave as some of the people I saw. I wished I could walk up to strangers and engage them in conversation. I don't know what I would have said or done. It would have felt good, though, having that confidence and making friends. I watched the people talking at the bar. I watched people dancing on the floor. I saw them in freeze frame in the light of my strobes. They glowed red in the light of my lasers, and they glittered with the lights from the mirror ball. The DJs always used the mirror ball for the slow dances. I knew everything there was to know about lighting the dance floor and lighting the people. But the people themselves remained a mystery to me. I could not figure them out. I never set foot on the dance floor unless I was fixing or adjusting something. I couldn't dance. I was clumsy, and I was sure I would look incredibly stupid. I had learned by then not to put myself in situations where people would laugh at me. Anyway, I was too shy to ask anyone to dance, and too self-conscious to accept if anyone asked me. I watched people doing lines of coke and popping pills at tables, in plain sight of the sound booth. Sometimes I'd see people shooting up on the steps in the alleys out back. Heroin was scary. I'd read how you could become addicted with a few pricks of the needle, and I saw how the addicts lived. In dumpsters, and passed out in doorways. No way am I going to do that, I thought. That was even worse than my father's drinking. I watched it all with the same detachment I had learned to feel when I was excluded from playing with kid packs when I was 5. No one made fun of me, but I still could not integrate myself into the groups around me. I wanted to make friends, but I didn't want to engage in the activities I saw them doing. So I just watched. And I worked. And I stayed, convinced that it was better to be destitute in Amherst than in New York City. The trouble was, the effects I wanted to design were getting more and more complex. I was starting to use microprocessors in my designs, and I couldn't afford the equipment to make and test my circuits at home. I needed a lab, but I was reluctant to go back to the university because they'd want to enroll me in some kind of organized school program, and I'd had enough of that. I needed the resources of some still nameless corporation. I realized it was time to get a real job. Everyone else had jobs, except the lowlifes sitting in doorways downtown. I didn't want to be one of them. I started reading the Help Wanted ads, looking under Electrical Engineer. I wondered if anyone would hire me. Most of the ads were faceless, boring ads for boring companies. One ad caught my eye, so much so that I still remember it. Money problems? Woman trouble? Running from the law? You can find a home in the Foreign Legion. I thought it was a joke, but it wasn't. The Foreign Legion was actually advertising for mercenaries. It was a shame I wasn't looking for what they had to offer. Adventure, discipline, male companionship, and the chance to fight battles far from home. I focused on local ads. Process control, jet engine testing, quality assurance engineering, field service rep, sales engineer, CNC programming. But I could not imagine myself doing any of those things. I didn't even know what most of them were. Then, at the bottom of the last page in the Sunday paper, I saw it. Electrical engineers. Be part of the team designing next season's hottest electronic games. That was the job for me. I called immediately and was told to drop off a resume. Resume? I had never made one. So I started reading up on how to write one. By the next day, I had made up a fine-looking resume, and the majority of the stuff on it, everything but my age and education, was actually true. I guess I did a good job because Catherine, from personnel, called the next day to schedule an interview. She also told me a little more about what they were looking for. They were designing sound effects. They wanted to make games that talked and listened. They wanted people with experience in audio and digital design. I can do those things, I said confidently. My Aspergian ability to focus and learn fast saved me. Between Sunday, when I read the ad, and the interview 8 days later, I became a passable expert in digital design. My head was spinning, but I had absorbed the contents of 3 engineering texts from the Graduate Research Center Library. When interview day arrived, I put on my suit and drove down. Actually, I was lucky I even had a suit. I had bought it the previous summer when Kiss was interviewed for a TV show while touring in the South. It was light gray, rough silk from Christian Dior in Charleston. It was bought on the expense account, so I could thank Kiss for my natty appearance at my first job interview. It was a long day of questions and answers. I started with Paul, the manager of the R&D group. Then I met with Klaus, the senior engineer. Then I talked to Dave, the mathematician who was designing the speech synthesis system. Finally, I talked to Jim, the group vice president. It was an incredible piece of luck for me that the things they wanted were the things I knew the most about. And even better for me, they had not found one single applicant with any knowledge of sound effects. Of course, I made it sound like I designed my sound effects devices at a real lab, as they did, not on my kitchen table, or in a motel room, or on the floor in some civic center, the way it really happened. At the time, I was very worried by my lack of legitimacy, but now I realize it didn't matter where I created those things. What mattered was that I had done it. I had done it for KISS, and I could do it for them. What do you know about digital filters? They asked. Nothing, but I can learn fast, I thought. What do you know about sound effects? I was on solid ground with that one. I've designed filters to modify the sounds of musical instruments, and I've designed all manner of signal processors for sound reinforcement and recording. I've also designed circuits for monophonic and polyphonic synthesizers. Once I got going on that topic, I didn't stop. The letter arrived in the mail 2 days later. It began, Milton Bradley's Electronics Division is pleased to offer you the position of staff engineer in our advanced R&D group. Your starting salary will be $25,000 per year. I couldn't believe it at first. Then I felt proud and also scared. Could I do it? I was about to find out. I called right away and agreed to start work the following Monday. I figured I'd better start quickly before they had a chance to change their minds. When I reported to work, I was pleased to find other geeks and misfits I could talk to. Most of the engineers were about my age. They had just spent 4 years in college. I had spent 4 years on the road. Since I had grown up around the university, I fit in fine. Several of the guys at work had even graduated from UMass, and we knew some of the same professors. We had a few senior engineers who were quite a bit older, and they were supposed to watch over the rest of us. I was assigned to Klaus, whom I had met during my interview. He was old and cranky, but extremely sharp. We got along well. I had never worked in an organization before, so I watched carefully to see how it worked and where I fit in. At the top of our organization, we had the senior VP, a blonde German fellow who wore suits and did not speak to underlings like us. He had a large office at the other end of the building and a pair of secretaries guarding it. The next level down was another VP, an ex-Marine we called the Juice. He'd been given the name by Bob and Brad, two of my fellow engineers, and it stuck. He said, "What you assholes need is some military discipline." That pretty much spelled out his attitude toward me and the other engineers. The next level in the corporate food chain was occupied by Paul, the manager of our group. Paul believed he should smile and talk nicely to us, and he smiled all the time. If Juice had the stick, Paul had the carrot. I didn't trust him. I wasn't very good at reading people's expressions, but I knew people smiled when they were happy. Well, he couldn't be happy all the time. I wasn't happy all the time. I wasn't even happy most of the time. I certainly didn't smile all the time. Why did he? He didn't seem to be on drugs. Something was up with him. And then there was us, the engineers. One of the first guys I made friends with was Bob Jeffway, who worked across the hall in product development. Bob was a prototypical geek, tall, thin, with signs of future baldness. He had a white dress shirt and a pocket protector filled with three pens and a small screwdriver. I quickly discovered that everything was a joke to Bob. I may have been the class clown in high school, but he was the company prankster here.
"So, I hear you're working for Little Ugly."
Bob had nicknames for everyone I saw. The Juice, Mr. Chips, Hooligan, The Snout, and Earth, Wind, and Fire. I smiled. Little Ugly, I thought. It did fit. But I learned an awful lot from Klaus. And I never called him Little Ugly, except in conversation with Bob. Our group was designing the first talking toys, and Klaus assigned me to work on an analog-to-digital converter he had been developing. The converter would be used in the lab to study voice and sound patterns. It sounded right up my alley. Right from the beginning, people were impressed by my designs, and they worked. I was off and running. I had been terribly afraid of what I'd find in a real job. But when I got there, it was easy. No one stood over me with a whip. I never once heard, "Come on, Ampy, move your ass! We need this stuff now!" They seemed willing to pay me to think up new designs at my own speed, in my own space. It was unbelievable. The air was clean. There was no haze of sweat and cigarette smoke anywhere. The heat worked. No one carried a gun, at least not as far as I could see. There were no drunks passed out in our doorways, and our washroom sinks were never used as toilets. We didn't have any coke dealers or hookers in the parking lot, and it was always safe to walk to your car when work was done. I realized that my coworkers had no idea how lucky they were. They took it all for granted. During that first week at work, I resolved that I would never again return to life in the gutter. Within a year, I was responsible for projects on my own. I seemed to have made it into the normal world at last. If I was careful, I thought, no one would find out about my past. Chapter 19. A Visit from Management. Now that I had a real job, I figured the time had come to act like a grown-up. After all, I was almost 23 years old. I was a design engineer at a big manufacturing company. And I had a lab of my own, with state-of-the-art test gear even better than what I'd used at the university. For the first time in my life, I put on a nice button-down shirt and a tie each morning. I was even on time, most of the time. The strange thing was that I found myself reporting to work in a factory. The electronics division had sprung up overnight, it seemed, and there was nowhere else to put it. Eventually, we would work in a nice new wing of corporate headquarters, but at that time, it was still under construction. So they gave me a photo ID that identified me as a member of management, and I trudged in through the factory entrance alongside 1,500 injection molders and printing press operators every morning. At least the salaried people like me didn't have to stand in line with the laborers and punch a time clock. I don't know what I expected life as a professional to be like, but it wasn't walking through a factory in between two-story high plastic molding machines, jumping aside when one of the machines decided to spit 50 pounds of hot plastic into the path in front of me and spatter my new Bally loafers with little balls of molten plastic. I collected some of the smaller plastic turds, 5 and 10 pounders, and laid them in my backyard like products of some chemically treated cow. Yellows, reds, blues, and an occasional one in mixed colors. Visitors to the house looked at them, but no one had the courage to ask what they were. "You'll be out of the factory soon," our boss Paul said. The juice and the other higher-ups were already over at headquarters. But until the new wing was finished, we were stuck in the factory. And R&D, of which I was a new member, was located above the injection molding machines in an overheated garret in what used to be the attic of the factory. Just imagine the scene. 17 engineers, plus one secretary, a manager, and an intern up in the attic, all designing as fast as we could. In the summer, it was brutal up there, because all the heat from the factory floor rose to the top floor, and the sun roasted us from above, cooking the black tar roof. Black spots, bits of hot tar from the roof, began peeking through the nice hung ceiling that August. I retreated to our technician's lab in a cooler part of the factory. Vito was in charge of the technicians, and, as a staff engineer, I was in charge of Vito. Sort of. Vito was really ungovernable. But he and I worked together well. Like a good sergeant in the Army, Vito showed us engineers how things really worked. For example, Vito showed us how to get rid of a pesky salesman with real flair. The salesman gambit took two people. Vito always did the intro. Here's how it worked. When a salesman made a bad impression on Vito, he would say, "When you meet my boss, ask him about his sister. She just won the NCAA swimming championship at her college. He's really proud of her." The salesman would meet me, and after a few minutes, he would invariably say, "So I hear your sister's some kind of champion swimmer," or some similar drivel. I would look shocked and say nothing. After a moment, the salesman would say, "Did I say something wrong?" To which I would reply, "I can't believe you would say such a thing. My sister had polio. She's been in a wheelchair since she was 5. Reactions to that statement varied, but they were always good. Sometimes I got an apology, other times shocked silence. It worked either way. After a few moments of silence, I would say, "I've got to be getting back to work." The salesman was all too glad to get out of there. By that time, Vito had discreetly vanished. I would escort the embarrassed sales rep to the door. And that was it. No rep was a repeat visitor after that gambit. The technicians worked among the printing presses that printed the artwork for puzzles onto big sheets of finished cardboard. The sheets were carried over to another group of giant machines that cut each puzzle into hundreds or even thousands of pieces before it was boxed and packed and shipped to stores. The work area was a former supervisor's office, a room about 10 feet wide and 50 feet long. Windows offered a panoramic view of the puzzle manufacturing operation on one side, and a plain sheetrock wall on the other. Everything was painted a sick pastel green, the color of fresh vomit, the kind you get from eating too many dandelions with your six-pack. This far from the personnel office, the usual rules for office decor, dress, language, and behavior didn't apply. After all, we were in the factory, not the executive suite. Our technicians had gone native. There were girly calendars on the walls, beer in the film cooler, and switchblades in the tool drawer. Paul, the manager with the perpetual smile, came to visit one morning.
"Guys, I need you to clean up your work area. We've got senior management coming to visit."
Paul was very polite. He never swore or raised his voice. But we knew what he really meant.
"Look, you assholes, this place is a disgrace. Get this shit off the walls and off the floors so we don't get our asses fired when the VPs come to check us out. Now!"
The techs started cleaning, slipping the calendars and porn into the backs of the cabinets, from whence they would pull them out again as soon as the tour passed through. Vito swept the floor, pushing the detritus over the railing. This was greeted with angry shouts from the factory floor 10 feet below as the trash fluttered down onto the wet ink on a line of puzzles emerging from the press. Rolled flat and cut and boxed, Vito's cigarette butts and trash bits might make a novel addition to someone's Christmas present. He didn't give a damn, and if they came up the stairs, he'd send them right back down at the end of a broom handle. While the crew was cleaning up, I looked around for something to do. I wanted to be a good corporate droid. What could I do to help out? I couldn't sweep or wipe because I was management. Then I found a piece of broken mirror in the corner. We certainly didn't want broken glass lying around. I picked it up. Eyeing the white Formica countertops, I had an idea. I asked Vito for a razor blade from the drawer and began scraping it across the countertop, shaving the Formica into a neat pile. An hour went by, and the pile got bigger. The room was clean, but I was still working. The pile of fine white powder was starting to have the look of $2,000, maybe more. Fine white crystals, with just a hint of sparkle. I scraped the pile onto the mirror, then I took a fresh razor blade, and I cut some lines. Fat ones. I took a 20 from my wallet and rolled it up tight. I set it next to the lines. The tableau was complete. I slid the mirror discreetly under the corner of a workbench. Visible, but not too visible. Something anyone in a hurry to clean up could have missed. I hoped no one would steal my 20. I considered substituting a cut-off straw from the cafeteria, but the 20 just looked better. Otherwise, the room was spotless. We were ready, and right on cue, management arrived. Our little area filled up with middle-aged men in suits, some of whom had visitors' tags. They asked polite questions, but it was evident they didn't understand what we were doing up there, and most didn't care. Two of them were brazenly discussing golf in low whispers right in front of me. Standing in the corner by the door, I noticed more than one head swivel to look at my little mirror. As I expected, no one said a word about it. The tour filed out. Because I was the ranking management representative, they all shook my hand as they departed. It was late, and we decided to wait till morning to redecorate the room. We talked about the mirror and the suits. How many noticed it? What would they say? We were kind of excited, thinking security was going to barge in, confiscate the mirror, cause a big scene, and send it out for testing so they could make an example of us. Frankly, we were surprised when by 5 o'clock nothing had happened. We headed home, careful to lock the door behind us. Maybe the raid will happen tomorrow, I thought. I could just imagine it. Our own rent-a-cop force, pretending to be the DEA, and after all their testing and analysis, they would find that their confiscated drugs were a pile of plastic dust. We anxiously awaited the vigorous enforcement of the company's anti-drug policies. But security didn't show up. "Is it possible they missed it?" I asked. None of us could figure it out. In the morning, I checked in at my office, such as it was, in the attic, then headed for the lab. I stepped through the doorway and saw the lads had been busy. The calendars were back on the wall, and we had a new penthouse pet over the door. But there was a problem. Almost half my coke was missing. I showed it to Vito. "Can't you be more careful? I spent a long time making that shit, and now you've lost half of it." "None of us touched it. Look, your 20 is still there." Vito insisted our techs had nothing to do with it. Maybe he was telling the truth. Maybe not. We'd see. I got a fresh razor blade and made a new pile. Now I had $2,500 piled up. I put some in a plastic bag. I'd heard $35,000 bought a whole kilo, and I wasn't sure I could get that much off our benchtops, but I had a goal. The bag was half full by the time I knocked off for lunch. The next day, my pile was down again. I showed Vito. "Someone's fucking with us," I said. Vito agreed. He had an answer. "Time for some video." We had video cameras left over from our robot experiments the previous fall. We rigged one so that it sat on a table facing the workbench and the door, focused on the mirror. Then we disconnected the switch for the building security system and rewired the switch to the start button for the camera through a timer that we whipped together from a 555 timer chip and a few parts. Whenever someone opened the door, the camera would come on for 5 minutes. With all the other electronic equipment in the room, we were sure no one would notice. Just in case, we left a radio and some idiot toys running all night, so the noise of the camera wouldn't be noticed. The factory made the whole area noisy anyway. It was a simple system, but it would probably work. We figured we'd catch one of our own crew messing with us. That's why we rigged the recorder after they all had left for the day. The next morning, the bag was gone. Vito saw it first. "Someone's fucking robbed us again!" We played the tape, and we were shocked. Watching that tape was like buying porn and finding your mother as the star. Right there in front of us, one of the VPs from the visit earlier in the week came in, did a line, and stole our bag of coke. He looked around furtively, pocketed my stuff, and walked out the door. Right before our eyes. On tape. We were speechless. People like him were supposed to set the moral compass of a huge company. People like us were supposed to be the thieving coke fiends. Vito thought we should confront him. I wasn't so sure. This executive looting wasn't what I expected when I left the mirror lying on the bench. I was looking for some fun. I wanted to cause a ridiculous scandal, to be accused of illegal possession of plastic dust. I wasn't expecting to find a vice president coming into our office after hours and robbing us of drugs. And good drugs, too. Stuff I had spent hours carefully preparing using only the cleanest and finest sections of countertop. If the stuff he stole was real and we turned him in, he'd be looking at 5 to 10 in state prison. Maybe our coke problem was just the tip of the iceberg. I said to Vito, "Who knows what else this asshole is stealing from other people here?" I was afraid that if he found out about our little scheme, he'd turn us into personnel, or even security, and we'd be fired. Or worse. I thought we should toss the mirror and let the matter drop. In the end, we decided to give it one more night. Maybe he'd have regrets. Maybe he'd return my coke. That night, I laid out 6 nice fat lines. The next morning, 4 were gone. What was he thinking? I know what I was thinking. This guy has been doing straight engineering lab for Mica for 5 days, and he's coming back for more. Maybe we can sell it. Maybe we should investigate where this Formica came from. Vito looked at the new evidence, and we decided to confront him. Vito was better at that sort of thing, so we agreed he'd do the talking. He had an uncle who collected delinquent loans for a local bookie, and when Vito was little, he went with his uncle to collect money on days when there was no daycare. He was a 5-year-old bat boy turned electronics technician. Vito called up to the executive offices and requested an appointment. The following afternoon, he headed upstairs, entered the office, and discreetly shut the door. I've got something I'd like you to see, he said. He had the tape and a portable player. He turned it on. Both days were on that tape. It wasn't pretty. There was silence afterward, but Vito could see what he was thinking. I can't believe they had fucking cameras. You know, you're goddamn lucky he didn't wire that bag to a hand grenade instead of a video switch, Vito said casually. My boss is crazy. We both knew people who rigged Vietnam War surplus grenades and claymore mines to guard their pot fields in the woods. They sometimes blew up a deer, and occasionally a hiker would lose a leg. You saw it in the paper from time to time. Vito continued. My boss is very upset over what you've done. He'd like to be paid for what you've taken. He wanted to take matters into his own hands, turn it over to the guinea beaters, but I said I'd come see you and see if we can work it out. Peacefully. Vito was Italian, and he could say stuff like that. The guy completely caved. He didn't even threaten us. No bravado at all. Vito settled for $500. He gave the guy the tape. We could afford it. We had more. Vito said, You understand you'll have to buy your shit somewhere else in the future. The guy nodded, grateful to have both legs and be off the hook so cheap. Vito and I had a hell of a party for the crew that weekend. They had their own drugs. I took the 20 off the benchtop and spent it, but not on coke. Its brief career as a straw was over. From that day forward, any requests we sent to the executive offices were answered promptly and never, ever rejected. But it didn't last. The economy changed and sales declined. Within a few years, some of us quit and others were laid off. I read that our former VP got arrested downtown, on the street with the pimps, whores, and crack dealers. Why would he do that? I asked myself. I had left that life behind for good the second I got the chance, when I quit the disco sound booth for a real engineering lab. He had grown up in luxury and had a good job as a VP at a big company and had climbed into the gutter of his own volition. Until then, I thought people who had been born to these upscale white-collar jobs must be inherently superior to a high school dropout like me. But I was wrong.